Father, I thank you for every person that's here. I thank you for creating me, for creating them. And I ask you to pour your truth and peace and freedom and blessing and mercy upon us. You've already done it, Lord, but help us to see you, Lord, to see your Son high and lifted up, having all authority in heaven and on earth, and faithful to fulfill all that you've promised from the beginning to the end. And I ask you, Father, for your help now, that you would cause me to and use me for your purpose, Lord, and cause me to speak the things that you have desired, and bring blessing, and I ask that you glorify yourself through us all. You've chosen us for your glory and to glorify you and to glorify us. I thank you. You have it all covered. Just breathe on each person here and bring blessing in Yeshua's name. Amen. Well, here we are. Jacob is coming back to the promised land after a long time. And he's coming back in the direction of the brother that wants to kill him. Right? He was sent away because his brother wanted to murder him. And now he's coming back. And when I think about Jacob, what do you think when you look at Jacob? You think he's usually thinking about, like, himself? And what angle to take? What do you think? Is he, like, intensely self-focused? He and his own. It does kind of seem that way, doesn't he? Doesn't it? I don't know if it's possible to just study Jacob and see how broad his view was. I think I think he had a sense of what was promised and he really wanted it, but a lot of what he does, and it seems like it breeds somewhat similar things in his sons, really seems to be about getting the immediate thing taken care of according to his calculations, and then asking God to help him with it. And of course, on his way to where he's now coming back from, he sort of tells God that he'll do well for him if God, you know, sees to his end, right? I'll give you a certain percentage of all that you give to me in return for giving it all to me and taking care of me. Anyway, so I imagine it's obvious to you that after I would mention those things, I would go to Revelation chapter 7, right? Let me make sure here. I think I wrote the reference down. Yes, I did. This is not too far after the passage that Dean read. I'll just start at the 9th verse. It says, "After this I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, 'Salvation belongs to our God, who sits on the throne, and to the Lamb.' And all the angels were standing round the throne and round the elders and the four living creatures, and they fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, 'Amen. Blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever.'" Anyway, so this great throng from every tongue and tribe and nation. And that's what I see when I see Jacob marching back towards his brother, who he's obviously very worried about. I see this great throng of every tongue and tribe and nation. And I don't know if Jacob was thinking about that at all. I really don't. I suspect at that time he wasn't. He has more depth of insight during the course of his life than it sometimes looks like in the circumstances of, you know, what he has to take care of, I think. and when he blesses his sons at the end, it's clear that it's not just about figuring the angles. But here he is returning. And as usual in Genesis, there's too much in each portion. The year should be several weeks longer so that the portions in Genesis could be shorter. But then that would require changing everything about the world to make that work out that way. So anyway, there is this striking thing that happens, and I'm going to just try to string these things together and see what we end up with. But a while ago we were talking about Ishmael and Isaac, and one of the things that's always striking to me is that the two of them came together and buried their father, Abraham, when he died. And in this week's Torah portion, I have to jump ahead in order to do this, and then maybe jump back. But and I've got things marked in two different Bibles, and that's just hunky-dory, because that makes it even easier to keep track of everything. So let's see. In the chapter 35, of Genesis, Isaac dies. And I probably shouldn't rush ahead to this, right? But I am. So, let's see, where is this? Did I write it down correctly? Yeah, Genesis 35. Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre of Kiriath Arba, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Now the days of Isaac were 108 years. Isaac breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, an old man of ripe age, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. So I don't know if you know, but in Jewish tradition, when Jacob is on the one side of the Jabbok and he wrestles, do you know who he wrestles with? In whose tradition? Well, the Bible itself doesn't really make traditions exactly. People that study it form traditions. And just to be fair to anybody that's thinking anything here, my friend Jacob Neusner said that the Talmud contains everything and its opposite. So anyway, the tradition has it that Jacob wrestled with Satan, and that he clung to God while he was wrestling with Satan. I may not delineate this in anywhere close to perfection, but part of it actually says within the tradition and the commentaries and everything that either the messenger of Satan or Satan, who is called the angel of Esau, who then bears the face of Esau, Esau then looking like the devil, which then gets connected to when he meets Esau, he says, I see you as one who sees the face of God. I won't be able to make this quite make sense to you. But they're talking about, in that vein of tradition, that the angel of Esau is Satan, and that Esau, of course, is the ancestor of all these enemies of Israel, which in that is true, and that Esau in much of the literature actually represents Rome. The name Esau refers to Rome. At any rate, so he looks away or isn't really clinging to God at some point, and that's why this being is able to injure him. What do you think? What? So, yeah.
I just had a question. Maybe I just didn't catch it. What tradition was that from?
Jewish tradition. Yeah. I couldn't possibly give you all of it. I don't know. Did you have any comments, Noah? Anyway, does anyone wonder at all if the whole time Jacob was wrestling, he knew who he was wrestling with? What? He does ask him, but he isn't given an answer. Just to bring it closer to home, part of my struggle here is that the whole thing is so broadly cosmic that it's like gazing into the sky on a really clear night in a part of the world that doesn't have any light pollution and no dust in the atmosphere. It's just kind of overwhelming. But how many of you do you think have ever had a real intense struggle and felt that it was all from the enemy and found out later that it was God doing his work? It seems that a few people have thought that. And sometimes it's also the way it seems when someone's looking at others, like looking at Yeshua, for instance, and his disciples deciding that the last thing that should ever happen in human history or the history of the whole universe is that Yeshua would be crucified. And then, you know, they're not getting it. They're not seeing that that's God's will. And sometimes in terms of our own suffering, we may try to avoid it, and it could be some of the suffering that is involved in following Yeshua, though there is suffering that's unnecessary. And we don't need to try to cause ourselves suffering just to make sure that we suffer for the sake of Yeshua, because that part will work itself out if we just pay attention to what we're supposed to. So, anyway, when we were in Phoenix, I don't know if I was going to mention this or not, but Asher Entrader spoke, and at one point he brought up Ishmael and where Ishmael's name came from, and that Ishmael was the name of Ishmael was delivered by divinely in this whole thing. And if you don't know, Asher for a certain amount of time now has been living in the consciousness that at one time he had a certain sort of Jewish pride, and that could sort of make a hedge that would keep certain people out. And the knowledge and understanding and love and compassion, I'm not saying that he was against people per se, but I'm saying that he has spoken of a change in his own view. And I was really struck by it, because the thing was, just recently I was so struck by it. And when he brought it up, that along with other things that have been happening and efforts to form relationship with Arab brothers among the Jews in the land and just a whole bunch of things like this, really make me think about, well, this throng of every tongue and tribe and nation. And so we start out in Genesis with nothing, and the God who is everything makes everything from nothing. And he creates people who are able to make nothing into a really big thing. Have you noticed that? But in the beginning, there's this relationship and there's this family. Is it a family? It's two people, Adam and Eve. Is that a family? Yeah, it's family. And there's this relationship with, well, Abba. I guess that's family, right? The family of God. God and the people he has created. And so they break the relationship. And then from Adam, out of Adam are divided all the peoples of the world. So there is only one humanity. But from the very beginning, God had this plan that all the families of the earth would be blessed, right? From the very beginning, even when there were no families. And they all are divided out of Adam. And then, you know, well, he destroys the earth at one point, but then they multiply again. And then at Babel, they're deciding, it seems to me, they're going to storm heaven. They're going to just, you know, build this tower and make a name for themselves. And I don't know if the idea of the tower was to get up to God's throne and sit on it. I don't know. I mean, that seems like that's what Adam and Eve were basically trying to do when they sinned, right? They were trying to be God unto yourself is trying to sit on God's throne, essentially. So God scatters the people, confuses their language, and they spread all over the earth. And then, so it's getting broader and broader and broader. And then when he chooses Abraham, it almost seems like it narrows down and there's this focus on this one family and this one group of people. Does it seem that way to you? I mean, in a way that does happen, but it isn't really narrowed down. God's not thinking of only one small group of people and the people are going to come from him. He's thinking of all the families of the earth. So everything that's going on with Jacob when he's trying to get his way, he wants the birthright. Isaac throws it away. But I suppose that wouldn't have happened, at least not that way, if Jacob hadn't been willing to just to take it for a bowl of soup. I mean, I have to say that I would think if I got something that big for a bowl of soup, I might feel guilty for having done it, even though the person that gave it is despising their birthright. So, anyway, then it continues. And let me... Okay, I'm jumping all over, but here's what God says to Jacob back as he's heading out to where he's now coming back from. He says, "Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." So, this is his promise to Jacob, and the promise that given to Abraham and to Isaac is passed on to Jacob. He's now carrying it. And God once again is promising to do all that he's promised and to be faithful to it. And this again has to do with all the families of the earth being blessed. And I don't know about you, but I find it very encouraging that God promises to stay with somebody like Jacob and not ever leave him until he's accomplished everything he promised. Because this seems to be just one of the many proofs in the scriptures that it isn't really about how perfect the person that's following God is or the person that God chooses. It's not about their perfection. It's about God's plan and his faithfulness. And yes, it is about the relationship. And yes, he does develop Jacob's character. I try to imagine it sometimes as a long process of character building in Jacob's life. He lived a lot longer than people do now. And it doesn't seem that necessarily his character developed super quickly. You think? But God isn't going to leave him because he's simply part of the plan. And, well, not simply. I mean, I believe God actually loves the people that he chooses to love and that he has a real relationship with them. And, so, Forgive me, I am experiencing some technical difficulties. So, let me just try to frame this again. So we're all caught up in this cosmic drama. The drama that Jacob was part of then is the drama that's continuing now. Of course, the Messiah has come and a number of things have changed, but we've been called into all the families of the earth being blessed. And the Lord is calling us to see in every other human being. I think we could say that as Jacob and Esau meet again, and Jacob says something like, I see your face as the face of God. Everyone's made in God's image, and what Jacob is doing, well, by the gifts, he is trying to appease anger, right? He's afraid. He's afraid of his brother. It seems apparent that Esau had absolutely no ill intent or any intention of harming Jacob when he sets out. I suppose somebody could argue, well, I think he was angry, but as the gifts came along, he started to feel better. What do you think? It doesn't seem, he had had just as much time to think about things as Jacob had while Jacob was gone. What? Well, that's true. I mean, he certainly had his own means. So, whether it's a brother or whether it's somebody from another family, but I don't know, is there anything but brothers and sisters in the world? I mean, in terms of there being, there is only one human family. We've tried so hard to divide it up, and nowadays it seems like we're trying to really hard to divide it up in more ways, even beyond ethnicity and everything else. We keep coming up with more categories to divide people into different groups and to claim special rights and special understanding and special everything. And it may not all exactly be wrong, but I think it's not. I think it's focused on the wrong thing. It's focused on either me and mine, or our, a very small our, and insistence on our rights when it should be the revelation of having been made in God's image, being loved by Him, and not needing to fight our own fight in our own power for our own rights, whether that's civil rights or rights to serve God the way we want or whatever. I'm thinking that Jacob is beginning to understand some things. He really is filled with fear, and he's pleaded with God to protect him, and God's promise is reiterated again, and God is going to take care of him, but he's very afraid. And what happens is they end up, Esau weeps on Jacob's neck, and he tries to turn the gift down. And I suspect that unlike the deal that Abraham made for the field in the cave of Machpelah, well, where the first overture is, oh, just take it. You know, you can have it. And ends in being charged something like 68 years pay for the average worker at the time for a little tiny piece of ground. I suspect that Esau really is saying, I have plenty, I don't need it. It's you know, the thing is, Jacob, I think, do you think he only wants to appease Esau's anger, or do you think he wants some reconciliation himself? What? He has been humbled. He's been humbled pretty much the whole time he's been gone. He knows that he's essentially, in practical terms, in his brother's power, that he couldn't have really defended himself. And he is trying to make amends. And he does show Esau honor. And the way that he speaks to Esau, well, I don't think it could be taken as anything but honor, could it? He's offering gifts, and he's acting submissive. Anyway, there's a reconciliation there. And then he continues on, but... I'm going to read you part of Romans 9. And it says, 9:9, I'll start there. For this is the word of promise, at this time I will come and Sarah shall have a son. And not only this, but there was Rebekah also, when she had conceived twins by one man, our father Isaac, for though the twins were not yet born, and had not done anything good or bad, so that God's purpose according to his choice would stand, not because of works, but because of him who calls. So that God's purpose, according to his choice, would stand. Do you love that line? Yeah, I can't read that without thinking of my purposes and my plans. I think Jacob thought a bit about his purposes and his plans. I think we all tend to think about our purposes and our plans. And thinking about our purposes and our plans seems to be the source of a lot of misery. And in Jacob's life, his seeking, his purposes and his plans, even with some sense of what God had promised, seems to have brought on a lot of misery. I mean, how many of you ever ended up married to the wrong girl? And that's just the beginning. He didn't have the Torah to say, don't marry her sister as a rival. So that God's purpose according to his choice would stand, not because of works, but because of him who calls. You like that? I love that. Not because of works, but because of him who calls. Not because of me, but because of God and the way he is. It was said to her, the older will serve the younger, just as it is written, Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated. What shall we say then? What shall we say then? By the way, with reference to Esau I hated, there's so much stuff in tradition about Esau, and a lot of it's pretty negative. But do you think a bunch of the families of the earth came forth from Esau? What do you think? Esau had a bunch of descendants, and a bunch of people came from them. I can't tell you right offhand at the moment how many peoples, but a whole bunch of people. So if in Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, as the promise is transferred along, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed, you suppose that includes the family of Esau? And Ishmael, right? Ishmael, a whole mess of people descended from him. So when I read that and I think of Esau, and Esau doesn't mean just the individual, but it also means those that came from him, I can't possibly really allow myself to just think, well, there's this guy Esau, God hated him, and he also just hated everybody that would descend from him, and so he is not included in the families of the earth, all of which will be blessed. Right? Ironic, in a sense, that he descended from Abraham himself, right? An awful lot of people did. So at any rate, what shall we say then? What shall we say then? There is no injustice with God, is there? May it never be. For he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. So then it does not depend on the man who wills or the man who runs, but on God who has mercy. So this should be really, really good news. Have you ever been in a quandary and felt like things depended on you who wills? And felt like you who wills has to do something to make things happen? Have you ever felt that way? How many times a day do you feel that way? How many years have you spent feeling that way? You know, there's so much contained just in this 16th verse of Romans 9, so then it does not depend on the man or the woman who wills, or the man who runs, but on God who has mercy. It all depends on God who has mercy. God wills, and he has mercy. And we're all caught up in that. We're in his hand. And the promise to Jacob is the same promise that's made to us. God promises that he's never going to leave Jacob until he accomplishes all that he promised, right? So in Hebrews 13, it says, make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have, for he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you, so that we confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me? Can you confidently say that? You know, the scriptures tell us that Yeshua is not unable to sympathize with our weakness. I find that very comforting. He can sympathize with our weakness. But it's not the same as misery-loving company. He knows what we need, and he has what we need. And so he doesn't come and commiserate. His ability to sympathize is to understand our frame and our frailty, our human weakness, and then to compassionately, however that compassion is delivered, because sometimes compassion actually doesn't feel so comfortable depending on the instance, but God's compassion ultimately does feel like compassion. He knows what we need, he has what we need, and he gives us what we need. And so he's able to understand our weakness. So whether you feel like you can say it, whether you feel like you completely believe it, whether you're filled with fretting and worry about the future, whether that's this afternoon or next year or whatever, the Lord is promising this: I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. So that we confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me? God is faithful, and his promises are sure. And it would seem that we need every day to confirm that, and seek to just plant it firmly and stand on the truth that God has, he's redeemed us, he's cleansed us, he's given us a new life, he's made us the righteousness of God in Yeshua. He's called us into a purpose and brought us into the ministry of reconciliation. And if we seek his kingdom first, then whatever it is that's needed will be added to us. It will be supplied to us. And there is peace in resting at the feet of Yeshua rather than fretting. And he wants to teach us how to do that. And so I'm just going to, in closing, read the end of the book of Matthew. Again, it says, and Yeshua came up and spoke to them, saying, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I command you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. So, the purpose that we're here for is, well, to know God and to enjoy him forever, but in this age, before the age to come commences, we are here for a purpose, and that's to serve God in telling the truth and reaching this great throng of tribes and tongues and nations. He's actually caught us up into this whole drama of creating this big group of blessed families from all the earth, from everywhere. They all came from Adam. They spread out. They became so many different ones. And God, he created one little tiny humanity in the beginning. It spread and grew. It got separated, relationships got broken. He chose Abraham, kind of narrowed it down in a way, but it wasn't about that little group of people. It was about being a light to the nations and the light going out everywhere because of what God chose to do through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he's brought us into it. And he's creating, once again, one new humanity. One humanity under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. It's entirely biblical if you just put it in context. The Pledge of Allegiance may be about this country, but it just struck me yesterday when I was thinking about it. One humanity under God. And that's as far as it went. I didn't even think until just now. Yeah, indivisible. It can never be broken apart. With justice and liberty for all. There won't... Look, the day is coming when all these tears will be gone. And new heavens and a new earth are coming in which righteousness dwells. And Jacob's self-obsessed, self-pitying, conniving, calculating efforts to get things done were all caught up in God's cosmic plan, and I do think Jacob had a sense of that. I do think that he was fighting for God, for God's purposes. I think that it just took him a long time to begin to see, and I do think he was different by the end of this week's Torah portion, that it was in God's hands all along. God was going to bring it all about, whether he tried to make it happen or figured the angles or not. And that it's God who wills and God who calls, and it's all because of God who has mercy. I think he is beginning to see that ever so clearly and be so very, very humbled by the end of this week's Torah portion. And it's a glorious thing God's done and is doing. And if we're clear where our battle is and who we're wrestling with, we won't confuse what God's doing with an attack of the devil. And we'll be able to commit ourselves to him in peace and let striving cease, and then God's purposes will be what we're about. Father, I thank you for everyone here. I ask you just to breathe on us and oh, just help us to see, Lord, where the real battle is and what our focus should be, and to keep our eyes on Yeshua. And I just ask you to help us see that the love of the brethren continues and increases, that we would cling to you, that we would cling to the truth, that we would love our neighbor as ourself, and that we would tell the truth. You've given us everything we need for righteousness and godly living, and you've given us the victory in Yeshua. Help us to act and speak as those that have met your Son, Lord. And we know that we can. So what we'll do, Lord. Develop it in us. May the Lord bless you and keep you and cause his countenance to shine upon you, be gracious to you, and give you peace. Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmarecha Yair Adonai panabelecha v'yichunecha Yisa Adonai panabelecha v'yasem lecha Shalom.